This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Mike Kenyre. Later this hour, we'll be joined by the new chairman of the South Florida Water Management District's governing board, Sanibel City Council member Chauncey Goss, to discuss his new appointment and the board's recent approval of a more than $500 million contract to build the massive C-43 reservoir in western Hendry County. But first, next month, on April 20th, it will have been 20 years since the mass shooting at Columbine High School in Colorado. Over the two decades since, this country has experienced many more mass shootings. By now, the Columbine Massacre isn't even among the top 10 deadliest mass shootings in modern U.S. history. On today's show, we're joined by a man who was a student at the school and was injured during the attack. These days, he's an expert in addiction and recovery, having become addicted himself while recovering from his injuries. Austin Eubanks has devoted his career to helping those who have turned to substance abuse as a result of trauma. He's spoken to millions of people across the country about his personal journey and strategies for addressing the issues of substance abuse that are plaguing this country. Austin Eubanks, welcome to Gulf Coast Live. Thank you so much for your time today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
And the reason we're having Austin on is he'll be in town this Saturday for a mental health symposium exploring the damaging effects of trauma that's being presented by the David Lawrence Center in Naples. We're joined also in studio by that nonprofit's president and CEO, Scott Burgess. Scott, thanks for coming in to talk about this important topic.
Thank you for having me.
And we invite you to join our conversation. Have you or a loved one struggled with addiction? Give us a call. The number's 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So, Austin, I want to start with you, and I wish I didn't have to start here, but with what just unfolded last week in New Zealand, what is it like for you when yet another mass shooting shows up in the news?
Well, I think since Columbine, my growth and my own recovery, I've gone through a range of emotions that happen after a tragedy like this occurs. And at first, it was just detachment because I wasn't processing my own grief, so I wasn't able to handle it. And I would block it out and pretend like it wasn't happening. And now, it really is from a place of empathy and sadness and frustration that we continue to see steadily building examples of these tragedies. I think that for me, looking at the tragedy, a tragedy like Columbine 20 years removed, I really see the impact as being so much broader than what oftentimes the general public sees. They see a few hundred people directly affected. But when you look at that over a continuum, two decades removed, it's tens of thousands of people that are traumatized by these events. And I think it's making a real impact on our culture and now, unfortunately, worldwide.
Do you watch a lot of news and follow these things closely, or do you just have it, you know, on your periphery, kind of?
Well, with the work that I do today in trauma and addiction, I do follow it pretty closely. Unfortunately, I've had the opportunity to work in many communities after tragedies like this occur, trying to help people lean together and really focus on healing their emotional pain in a healthy fashion. But whereas I detached and turned to substances to be able to cope. And so part of my experience and the work that I do today is helping people learn healthy coping mechanisms after trauma occurs. So I follow it fairly closely because of that.
Let's go back in time, if you don't mind. What can you tell us about what happened that day 20 years ago next month?
Yeah, so it was a day just like any other. And in 1999, there was no frame of reference for what a school shooting even was. And so we had never done an active shooter drill. There was no such thing as an active shooter drill. And I remember when the shooting started and everybody started to say what was going on. I mean, we didn't believe that it was real. It wasn't until I actually saw the perpetrators in the library that day that I knew that what was happening was real. Unfortunately, we were in the library, myself and my best friend, and they approached our section last and each fired multiple shots under our table. And I was hit twice and witnessed the murder of my best friend right in front of me. And so, needless to say, life changed dramatically for me on that day. I was 17 years old. And prior to that, I had never ingested mind-altering substances of any kind, never drank, never smoked marijuana. And really, within a matter of weeks, I was medicating the underlying symptoms of my emotional pain with the medications that were prescribed for my physical injuries.
What were you prescribed?
Originally, it was opiates, and then I was given some medication to help me sleep. I was in shock, and I was pretty hysterical, as you can imagine. And I still remember, without even knowing it, everything just felt better when I took the medication. And there was never really any education given about how I was going to have an increased susceptibility to developing a habit because of the emotional impact of the trauma that I had just sustained. And so all that I was relying on was that I was prescribed medications to make me feel better, and they were absolutely working. And so it was very quickly that I started to take more than was prescribed. I was taking them at times that weren't prescribed. And from there, it led very quickly to alcohol, marijuana, illicit narcotics, really anything that would allow me to not be present and not have to engage in the stages of grief, because I was wanting the fast road to relief.
Were you seeing counselors or, counselors at that time, not just medical doctors, but, mental health counselors?
Yeah, absolutely. So I had access to a lot of services after Columbine. Renowned clinicians were coming in to donate their time. I had a family that had the resources to be able to get me whatever help that I needed. But the feedback was always the same. He's just shut down. He's not willing to engage in the stages of grief. None of the therapists that I was working with ever said, let me talk to his primary care physician. We need to form a collaborative treatment plan, and I need to know what medications he's taking. And I think that that's really where some of my treatment plan went wrong, is everybody was doing what they thought was in the best interest to help, but they were doing it in silos without collaborating with one another. And oftentimes, I think when trying to help, if it's not done in collaboration, it can hurt, and that was the case for me.
Yeah, that's exactly why I asked you that question, because I thought, I think maybe today that there has been that collaboration, and we'll get to that here with Scott Burgess and you a little later. But I want to stay back in time just a little bit. So talk about, how long did you struggle? How did you wind up in recovery? What was the impetus for that?
Well, it was a number of years before I was even willing to broach the topic of what addiction was. And so my first experience in addiction treatment was 2006, so 7 years, almost 7 years after the shooting. And by that time, my addiction had progressed, and my life was incredibly unmanageable. But my family and my wife at the time and my employer, everybody came together to kind of create some leverage to get me into treatment. And I went for 30 days and then unfortunately went right back to what I was doing. And what I learned at that time is, oftentimes our approach to treating addiction is that we're bringing people into an environment of safety and care for a very short period of time, and then we're sending them back right into the life that they came from, and we're telling them, hey, make sober decisions. And the problem is that addicted brains don't make sober decisions, and it takes a long time for a brain to heal from addiction. And so from there, I went to treatment two additional times until finally April 2nd, 2011, I made the decision to go into treatment, and I stayed for 14 consecutive months. And that was finally what it took for me to actually allow my brain to heal and process the grief and the survivor's guilt that I had from age 17. So I remember clear as day going through the stages of grief at age 29 that I should have been going through at age 17 and age 18, but I had just detached from it and turned to substances to cope, and it effectively paused my emotional growth and healing.
Hmm. So is that when you decided to get into the world of addiction treatment?
It was, yeah. So it was at that time that I made the decision to basically change everything about my life. And I had actually a list of people, places, and things in my life, and everything from my career to my relationship to my friendships. And literally every single one of those things supported the behaviors that I wanted to exhibit, which was a life of addiction and turmoil. And I slowly but surely replaced every single one of those things with people, places, things that held me accountable for being the absolute best version of myself. And so I walked away from a career in advertising, and I went back to school to study addiction, and then slowly got my foot in the door in this field. And it's incredibly rewarding to be able to now lend my personal experience to hopefully impact the lives of others to where they can learn and grow from that without having to go through the turmoil that I did.
Was that process of making that list something that was given to you as an idea through treatment, or is that something that you developed yourself?
Well, I think for me, when I tell people how I finally found recovery, it's because I figured out every way that doesn't work. And so I think that it was definitely advised that, look, you've got to change a lot of things about your life in order to be able to support long-term recovery. And then from there, I just sort of made a list of all of those things, and it was combined with a list of people that I needed to make amends to for the wrongs that I had done. And then slowly replaced all of those things with a life of pro-social accountability and support. And that was very essential to my recovery.
If you're just joining the show today, I'm talking with Austin Eubanks, who was a student at Columbine High School and was injured during the mass shooting there 20 years ago next month. These days, he's an expert in the addiction treatment industry and a nationally recognized speaker and consultant on topics surrounding drug policy, behavioral health, and addiction recovery and prevention. He'll be in town this Saturday for the David Lawrence Center's 6th Annual Sound Minds Mental Health Symposium. I'm also joined in studio by that nonprofit's president and CEO, Scott Burgess. Together, we're exploring how trauma can lead to addiction. If you have a story to share or would like to ask a question or make a comment, give us a call now at 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. So Scott Burgess, let's pivot to you. For starters, give us the short version of the David Lawrence Center for a listener who knows nothing about it.
Okay, well, the David Lawrence Center has been in the community for over 50 years, and we provide both mental health and addictions recovery treatment. We have services for children, adults, all the way through seniors, so the whole age spectrum. And we provide that in a multiple different modality component. So we actually have inpatient services. We've got traditional outpatient services. And then we also have community-based programming. So providing that service across a whole continuum of care and uniquely customizing treatment plans to try to meet the needs of everybody's unique issues that they're struggling with.
Does Austin's story ring true as far as the kinds of stories that you guys hear, you know, trauma, bury it, hide from it with addiction, could come to you and hopefully come out the other end and finally go through those stages of grief? Is that a common refrain?
Yeah, unfortunately, trauma treatment, like many other forms of treatment or issues that people struggle with, there's a long delay between the issues manifesting and when people get involved in care. So just in general, related to mental health issues, the research would suggest that it's about a 10-year delay between a person having their first onset of some symptoms to the first time that they're receiving treatment. And there's a whole list of reasons why that is in our society, some of which is related to stigma still. People are concerned about coming forward and seeking treatment. And then there's other, you know, real barriers that people have to access to care. There's a lot of those issues as well. But trauma is no different, and it manifests itself in many different ways and in unique ways. But one of the ways that seems relatively common is that people will kind of stuff that inward and try to deal with that themselves. And sometimes that can lead to destructive behavior, which, of course, you know, addiction being one of those behaviors that can become very problematic. And before a person realizes what's going on, there's a physiological addiction that is a major issue to deal with.
Is there a fundamental difference in any way between childhood trauma and trauma as an adult, because the childhood brain is still developing? That may not be exactly down the road that we're on now, but he was 17, so.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, one of the things that Austin relayed was when, you know, he was going through his trauma, that he felt like there was the developmental kind of hesitation or arrested development or just kind of stuck in that particular phase. But when you think about that with a child, that they're, you know, whenever their trauma may start, whether that's 8 years old, 9 years old, 10 years old, maybe even younger, of course, that's going to be problematic in their development. And those are the years where you're also establishing your ability to trust others. And when you go through a traumatic experience, maybe in a sense of like sexual assault or things of that nature, obviously is going to have a major long-term impact on a child's ability to develop that trust in an easy way as an adult.
Austin, does that resonate with you as to what you were going through back then in terms of being able to trust people around you, or were you just hiding from the trauma you had experienced?
No, it absolutely does. I mean, I think it effectively paused my emotional growth in many ways. It wasn't just the ability to address the trauma. I think that I stayed 17, 18 years old for the majority of my 20s because the level of substance abuse that I had just paused my emotional growth and development. And so I think that when something like Columbine occurs, and again, trauma doesn't always have to look like a tragedy like Columbine. Mm-hmm. It's different for many different people. And so I think that's important to note. But for me, it really reshaped the lens that I viewed the world through. So I had enormous survivor's guilt. I developed a maladaptive schema, which was basically my false core belief about the world, this fear of abandonment and shame that everybody who I loved or got close to was going to die or leave me. And those are some of the things that I had to work through. And so trauma reshapes the lens that you view your world and your environment through. And that was very much the case for me.
Hmm. Scott, how much has changed in the way we treat addiction since 1999? It seems like what he was describing as far as the siloing of the different worlds, we're blending that together in a more mindful way now, are we not?
Yeah, I think when we talk about effective care and evidence-based care, integrated care is really the best approach. So when you have your primary care doctors and in the primary care space working with those that are in more of a specialty area like mental health or addiction, it's very clear that we need to be on the same page. We need to be working together in relation to the medicine as well as in relation to the therapy and the therapeutic interventions that are being deployed. So we are getting better with that. I'd like to say that we are a fully integrated healthcare system in our country. We certainly are not. There are still many areas that are not integrated and still acting in silos. That's something locally here in Southwest Florida. We're working really hard to have an integrated system, but we've got work to do here. But across the country, it's still not uncommon to have silos that are still out there.
Not all addiction stems from trauma, I presume. What is known in your field about what are some of the other root causes of addiction?
Yeah, well, depression and anxiety are huge. We see that quite a bit when people come in that oftentimes when somebody's becomes involved with substances, they're using it as a coping mechanism. And so the question becomes, what's the root cause of that? What's going on in their life that's causing them to turn to those substances? And it could be trauma. It could be depression. It could be anxiety. It could be a number of other things, bipolar disorder. It could just be, issues that a person just feels completely overwhelmed and overloaded by what life is throwing at them at that particular point. So there's a lot of different etiologies or beginnings of why people would come to us. But depression, anxiety, and trauma are very high on the prevalence list.
Do you think that you just alluded to how busy and how many elements to life there seem to be now with social media and all the different ways we're interfacing the world, do you think that is leading to a greater risk of addiction for people?
I think the social media and the speed of responsiveness that we're in and the world that's moving at light speed all the time is having a dramatic impact on our global mental health as a society. Actually, last year at our mental health or at our Sound Minds symposium, we had somebody that spoke on her topic of screenagers, and she talked about how screen time is having a dramatic negative effect to children in the way that they are interacting with the world, and that in general, a child might have 2,000 Facebook friends, but they don't have one person that they feel that they can call and open up to. So it's actually not connecting us as much as it's actually pulling us apart and isolating us more.
We actually had her on this show. We did a whole show on when to get a cell phone was the nature of the show. Austin, can you reflect on how the world has changed in the way we were just describing between 1999 and now? Like, can you imagine what it would have been like if there was a Facebook back then or all the other ways that we interact with the world as compared to now?
No, absolutely. And so I'm the father now of two young boys, they just 13 and 9. And so I'm now trying to help them navigate these waters that they're in. And I definitely see the role of social media and screen time in general as being detrimental in many, many ways to this generation. And so I often use the reference, pay attention at a restaurant and it'll probably only take you a week and you'll see a toddler get upset at the restaurant. And it used to be 10 years ago, you'd see the caretaker pick up the toddler and they might add a pacifier or a stuffed animal to the equation. Now you're going to see that toddler being handed a smartphone or a tablet, and that emotion is going to immediately shut off like a tractor beam. And so my fear is that we're priming entire generations for dependent behaviors to seek something outside of themselves to feel okay, to regulate emotions. And then we're sending them out into a world where
unfortunately, drugs are more accessible and more deadly than ever before in history. And so the big change that's happened since Columbine is now the majority of people that I see coming into addiction treatment, when you ask them where they're acquiring narcotics, they're saying, I'm getting them on the internet. Priority overnight, and oftentimes they're coming to mom and dad's basement. And so the accessibility piece is huge. And when you combine that with the toxicity of substances like fentanyl, it's no wonder we are where we're at with the death toll from addiction in this country.
If you're just tuning in, we're exploring the damaging effects of trauma and how it can often lead to addiction. My guests are Austin Eubanks. He was a student at Columbine High School and was injured during the mass shooting there. He became addicted after the event and has spent the last 20 years working in the addiction treatment industry. These days, he's a nationally recognized speaker and consultant on the topic. I'm also joined by the president and CEO of the David Lawrence Center, Scott Burgess, who will be hosting Mr. Eubanks this Saturday for its 6th annual Sound Minds Mental Health Symposium. If you'd like to join our conversation about trauma and addiction, give us a call now. The number is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. What he was just alluding to, Scott, is it fair to say that the dangers associated with addiction are more dangerous these days because of things like fentanyl?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and Austin can speak to this directly as well, that the lethality with the fentanyl that's out there is has changed the game dramatically. So just on a national level, we will lose over 70,000 Americans this year due to overdose deaths. And that has now almost doubled the number of motor vehicle accident deaths in our country. So when we're talking about this being an epidemic proportions, statistically speaking, it absolutely is. We have to take this very seriously. We're seeing the deaths just continue to increase year over year.
Do you think that in a way that might help with the reducing of stigma, because it is such a serious – it's like you can't turn your eyes away from it and go, eh, it's not that big a deal. It's like a really, really big deal. Do you think that in some ways might be helping people admit that they need help?
Yeah, I think we're certainly seeing a lot more awareness and attention that's out there in the media, as well as many other ways that information is getting out to the public. So we're seeing that this is something that, you know, we say that addiction is, you know, it's a destroyer of all sorts. I mean, so it doesn't discriminate in any way, shape, or form. So we see families across the country that can look very different and look very much the same that are being destroyed by these opioid medicines, and we're seeing that treatment has been very effective when people have accessed treatment. There's evidence-based practices. There's medication-assisted treatment. So we've got some medicines now that have been helpful, as well as what we know clinically speaking and from a research standpoint, that it takes a multifaceted approach most often for people to overcome their addiction. You know, maybe medicine is a component of that. Therapy is a component of it. Individual therapy, group therapy, support groups. So there's a lot of different ways that people can get support in a way that's going to uniquely help them. I think the awareness has increased, and we just need people to not feel guilt and shame and step forward and seek that support. And I think that's getting a little bit easier with the increased awareness out there.
We did quite a few shows back in the mid to late 2000s about – it was during the rise of the pill mill when you know, getting a Percocet was – just as easy as walking in and saying, my arm hurts, and they'll give you a prescription. That's been cracked down on now. Now some people are even almost complaining that they've cracked down too far, where people with real pain issues can't get enough without having to go back all the time. Has that pushed people into this world of heroin laced with fentanyl?
Yeah, I think certainly there is with addiction kind of a path of least resistance. And oftentimes where there's a crackdown in one particular area, then people will navigate to their substance through another type of source. Florida has done a really good job in making sure that the doctors are checking the prescribing database in order to make sure that people aren't receiving medicine from multiple doctors. That was going on for a long period of time. Cracking down on that, I think, has made a huge difference, and we are seeing, you know, some patterns of people maybe going to other substances.
Austin, can you kind of reflect back on what it was that you were primarily addicted to, and can you envision what it would have been like with like a fentanyl hiding behind every new use?
Yeah, I talk about this often, and I've reflected on it as well. My drug of choice was OxyContin. I started being prescribed in 1999 opiates, which was 3 years after implementation of pain as the fifth vital sign. It was also 3 years after OxyContin came on the market with an aggressive campaign that we all know was geared towards saying that it was non-addictive for pain management. And so that was always my drug of choice, primarily because opioids are profoundly effective at relieving the symptoms of emotional pain. And that's what I was medicating, was the underlying emotional pain that was originally prescribed for my physical injuries. And so if I look at modern day, I've often questioned, would I still be alive? Because of the level of substances that I was using. And I know that I wouldn't have been able to discern between, you know, if you're sick and you need opiates to be able to get through the day as I did, it's kind of any port in the storm. I would have taken whatever. And if it would have had fentanyl in it, I would have had a much, much increased susceptibility to overdosing and dying. And so it is incredibly scary, modern day, the decisions that are being made. It's no longer really experimentation. Some of these decisions are life and death just because of the potency of these substances.
You know, Scott, I recently read about a new painkiller the FDA just approved called Dysuvia, I think. Are you familiar with it? It's apparently 10 times stronger than fentanyl.
I've heard of it before. I don't know that we've seen that.
Yeah, I don't think it's – I don't know if it's being used in practice yet. But, you know, what are your thoughts on that ramping up?
I'm extremely nervous about anything that would be more potent than fentanyl. I think we've seen how potent fentanyl is and how dangerous it is in our community. Clearly, the doctors have to be very forthright and very strong in their prescribing and controlled in their prescribing in order for us to keep this all under control. And as Austin relayed, there's a lot of people that are getting medications through the internet now.
Right.
So it's very hard to control the supply
right.
when people are interested in receiving those medicines.
Doctors don't prescribe fentanyl. Am I correct in that? Is that something that you only get in Austin, do you happen to know the answer to that? If not, we don't need to guess.
So, generally speaking, fentanyl would be only prescribed by a physician for terminal illness, cancer patients, and it's usually in a transdermal patch that's applied to the skin. And so, it's very, very rare that it would be prescribed by a physician.
And yet it still winds up on the streets, so it's clearly, like you said, coming from China or somewhere through the internet and the dark web and all that stuff.
Wait. Yeah, there's some pretty astounding statistics that are coming out about just search and seizure when it comes to fentanyl coming into this country. And Vice News did a phenomenal segment that looked at 2017 search and seizure statistics just from JFK's Customs Department. And in one calendar year, they seized enough fentanyl to overdose the population of New York City 11 times over. And so if you go off of current search and seizure statistics, you have to assume that 2 to 3 times that amount got through undetected. And so it is everywhere. And I think that is why conversations like this are so important, because it's up to us as a culture to change the way that these medicators are playing a role in our lives. I mean, there's a reason why we represent 4.5% of the world's population, but we're consuming over 90% of the world's total supply of opiates. And it's because as a culture, we have a profound lust to medicate.
I think we might have just lost Austin's phone call. He'll probably call us back here shortly. But I am going to pivot to you, Scott. Is there hope in the treatment world for a non-opioid painkiller that really takes away the pain in a way that the opioids do? Is that like the golden ticket, if you can find something like that?
Well, it is. I mean, there's a number of different methods to try to deal with pain, and certainly in other countries and other cultures, they have been working for a long, long while on utilizing non-medicine-related methods to assist with pain. So, you know, things like meditation, things like yoga. There's a lot of growing research that can help with pain issues.
Gotcha. Is it also about and Austin's alluded to this, and we're about to lock him back in here so he can weigh in on it. Hi, welcome back, Austin. It's not just about taking away pain, but it's the opioid painkillers. They cause pleasure, and is that the slippery slope, Austin? Is the pleasure side of oxycodone or OxyContin the slippery slope, not just the hiding the pain?
Absolutely. I mean, that was the case for me and for, you know, a lot of the people that I work with, is that it's that feeling of euphoria that just makes everything feel a little bit better. And that's what I was drawn to. I noticed that when I took the medications, I didn't cry as much. It wasn't as painful to think about the memories of Columbine. And not only that, I mean, it does improve the pain from physical injuries as well. So what I think is most important is the education piece of talking to people about, maybe you had a physical injury that requires medication, but if there is something going on underneath, whether it be anxiety, depression, unresolved trauma, or even a bad divorce that happened perhaps a few weeks earlier, you are going to have an increased susceptibility to developing a habit because you're inadvertently going to improve those symptoms as well. And that's something that I think the general public, by and large, doesn't know yet. And that's a really important message for us to carry.
You know, Scott, and you can weigh in on this too, Austin, if you'd like. Is there an analogy here to, like, if you twist your ankle, they don't want you to take the pain away too much because you might walk on your ankle and hurt it worse. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, does that mean that we have to find a way into treatment where we say you are going to have to, you know, experience pain? You are going to have to experience physical pain. You are going to have to experience emotional pain, or you're going to just risk the chances of making it much worse.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think that there's a couple of components. The one is, and I think Austin was alluding to it a little bit, we live in a society that's, you know, wants instant gratification in every different way, shape, and form, and especially when it comes to pain and resolving
right.
our pain as immediately as possible. I mean, you look at the television, you'll see, you know, how many commercials in an hour that talk about pain relief, right? So we are very focused on getting rid of pain as quickly as possible, not being able to tolerate pain for very long. So it's really a balance issue. I mean, if somebody is struggling so terribly that it's completely debilitating, mm-hmm. they might need something in short term. But I think it's definitely a conversation that we have to continue to have between providers and clients or patients to say, you're going to feel some discomfort, and discomfort can be painful, and that can be physical, and that can certainly be emotional. And let's work together to try to figure out how to get you through that pain. And the process itself can be very hopeful and helpful and therapeutic, where people can explore how to manage their pain in other ways. Maybe that's art, you know, art expression. It might be mm-hmm. music. It might be working with horses, equine therapy. It could be pet therapy. There's all these different ways that we can mitigate some of our pain emotionally as well as physically, and find other positive coping skills that are going to be helpful for us, not just in that immediate term, but in our long term. So it's going to be worth the process.
Austin, is that something that you talk about a lot, I imagine?
Oh, yeah, it definitely is. And I think that the way that I look at what's happening and the adversity that we're experiencing in a number of areas is it really is it's a cultural epidemic. And I think that when these beliefs are reinforced that, you know, we're Americans, we should feel great always. If I'm sad, there's a pill for that. If I stub my toe, there's a pill for that. And it goes even deeper when you look at the technology and all of the ways that we have to medicate and detach. And I think what I see is all of this is actually pulling us away from authentic human connection. And it's that authentic human connection that we are hardwired for as a species. And it is what is so essential to heal emotional pain. It's leaning on others for support from a place of authenticity and vulnerability and transparency. And I think today in our culture, it's so easy to detach and to isolate. And then you combine that with you know, being fed a constant stream of information that only reinforces our own beliefs. We're a culture that's filled with this animosity and resentment and rage and polarization. And so it becomes much easier to just detach, isolate, medicate. And I think that that's why we're seeing these trends continue to rise.
Austin, you've been in recovery since 2011, I think you said. Do you go to meetings of some kind or have groups, or what, you know, what is your routine in terms of support and, you know, staying on top of it these days?
Oh, absolutely. So that recovery is a never-ending process, and it hasn't been easy for me since 2011. There's been ups and there's been downs, and I always tell people it's not a straight line. It looks a lot more like a stock market slowly increasing, and so there's ups and downs. But what's so essential is that when you make a mistake, you own up to it, and you come back to others for support, and then you continue to move forward from that. And so that is that is crucial for me is that I continue to engage with the people around me that hold me accountable for being the best version of myself, and accept and understand that recovery is a never-ending process. It's always striving to be the best person that you can be and do the next right thing. And I think that that's so often where I see people have setbacks, and even in my own life, that's where I've had setbacks, is when I start to move away from that and kind of think, everything's okay, I've got this figured out, because you can't do it alone.
Hmm. What do you do, Austin, when you're not doing speaking events and this sort of work? What is your what does the rest of your life look like in a sentence or three?
Yeah, no worries. So I'm privileged to live in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, ski town, USA. So skiing and snow sports is a big part of my life. And then in the summers, I enjoy fly fishing and golf, which fly fishing was something that Corey and I shared together, who was my best friend, who I lost in Columbine that day. And for a large part of my addiction, I wasn't able to do that because it reminded me of him and it was just too difficult. And that was something that I was able to get back to in my own recovery. And so now fly fishing is a huge part of my life and really part of ways that I stay connected to him and his memory.
Do you keep up with any of your fellow Columbine students from back in the day?
You know, I lost touch with the majority of them through my addiction, and now in recent years we've started to come back together and communicate. And I think approaching the 20-year anniversary next month, there's a lot of work being done that's really looking at the impact of a tragedy like this on a community 20 years removed, by way of the people who turned to addiction to cope, or the people who unfortunately turned to suicide because they couldn't handle the pain, and then the way that trauma is passed down through generations. And so unfortunately, that work has brought a lot of us back together, but it is very valuable, those connections. And we actually opened up a lot of avenues between the Parkland students after that tragedy to lend support to them by, you know, the understanding of, look, we've been there before. This is where we went wrong. And these are some of the things that we did right to help hopefully create a roadmap for them.
Scott, we're running out of time, but, you know, he just mentioned the Parkland, the kids, you know, they're right across the state there. And during the 1 year anniversary last month, it's emerging the lockdown generation is what kids are calling it. You know, can you kind of just real quick, you know, it's sad, it's scary, and I hope it doesn't bode poorly for the future in terms of kids that are, you know, being traumatized by what we're trying to do to protect them too.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really a dilemma. Obviously, we need to make sure that kids are safe, and we need to make sure that they're understanding what to do in a situation like this, because sadly, these are happening with such great frequency. Mm-hmm. So we need to make sure that they're trained and they're aware. However, just think about how traumatizing that experience is in and of itself for, let's say, a kindergartner. Mm-hmm. That's 5 years old, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, now we're training them and we're giving them the insights that there could be somebody that could walk into their school mm-hmm. with an automatic rifle or some sort of weapon. And, you know, and when I talk about this sometimes in public, people will say, maybe from, you know, different generations, say, well, we had worries because we were worried about a bomb or, you know, things of that sort. And I say, but did a bomb come by and actually hit America
right.
every other week or once
right.
a month?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, so because of these things actually happening in reality and kids seeing it on television, they know there is a potential, a significant
right.
potential of sort. So it is one of those things where it's a balance. We need to make sure that they're educated and prepared, but I think it's no wonder that the kids are, this is probably the most anxious generation that we've ever had in America. And I think that's one example of it. And then you also have the, with the social media factor
right.
And variable, and those two things together is quite a challenge in our society.
It's interesting times. I remember when my daughter was in kindergarten, she had her first lockdown and she said, yeah, you know, we all hid in the bathroom with the lights off for a half an hour. And I was just like, okay, all right. Well, it's the new reality, I guess. Mm-hmm. That is all the time we have for this part of the show. I want to thank my guests. Scott Burgess is president and CEO of the David Lawrence Center. Scott, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
And Austin Eubanks, is an expert in the addiction treatment industry and a nationally recognized speaker. He was a student at Columbine 20 years ago. Austin, thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
The David Lawrence Center's 6th Annual Sound Minds Mental Health Symposium that will focus on the damaging effects of trauma is this Saturday, March 23rd, from 10 a.m. to noon at the Moorings Presbyterian Church in Naples. You can find a link with more information on our website, gulfcoastlive.org. When we return, we'll chat with the new chairman of the South Florida Water Management District's governing board, Chauncey Goss of Sanibel, about the big contract it just announced to build out the massive C-43 reservoir in Hendry County. I'm Mike Canary. You're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.